going back to your question of what I would like to do within the CMI, is I would like to focus on our members a little bit more in order to ensure that the CMI continues to produce work and make suggestions to the international maritime bodies on new areas of work which perhaps need more focus. And this can only come about if we engage more with our national maritime law associations, if we engage more with our titulary members, if we engage more with the industry.
Welcome to the Fennec and Fennec Advocates podcast, The Law Booth. My name is Martina Farrugia. I am a senior associate within the firm and the host for this month's podcast. Joining us today is Anne Fennec, head of the Marine Litigation Department and newly minted president of the Comité Maritime International. Welcome, Anne.
Hi, Martina. Thank you.
So today's topic will be about your presidency of the CMI and this huge project that after 9 long years is finally coming to fruition. I'm, of course, talking about the Convention on the International Effects of Judicial Sale of Ships. So in October 2022, just a few short months ago, you were appointed by the CMI as president. It was by all accounts a really, really big moment. And I'm sure it was a landmark moment in your life too.
I mean, I would be really lying through my teeth if I were to tell you no. Of course it was, Martina. It was a real fantastic moment. I mean, the actual election in the General Assembly held in Antwerp in front of all those National Maritime Law Associations where the committee was celebrating its 125th anniversary, I have to say was probably one of the most special moments of my professional life, unhesitatingly. And to this day, these months later, I still feel so hugely honoured, really honored by this. I don't know whether you're going to ask me the next question of how this came about. So if you are, I'll just stop there.
Yes, give me a chance. So firstly, for our listeners, can you please explain what the CMI actually is? And then yes, how did it come about? What was it like to find out that you had been nominated as president?
So the CMI stands for the Comité Maritime International, and it is an organization which is 125 years old, and its entire raison d'être, Martina, is the unification of international maritime law. Now, of course, I am assuming that most of the people listening to our podcasts are lawyers. When my audience is not legal, then I need to explain, you know, what conventions are and why we have conventions. So I don't have to do that here. So with this audience, I can launch straight into saying that the Comité Maritime International is responsible for drafting the vast majority of international maritime conventions. So whether we're talking about the Limitation of Liability Convention, whether we're talking about Salvage Convention, whether we're talking about Wreck Removal, the collision, all of these conventions was the work of the committee over the years. And so the main raison d'être, the main reason for being of the committee remains the unification of international maritime law. And why is that? And that is because of its very nature, ships traverse the world's oceans. They carry cargoes, they carry passengers from country A to country B. So it's obvious and it makes very much sense that as far as possible, the laws of different nations come together in a unified manner, more or less try to apply the same law, because of its very nature, shipping traverses so many different countries, and therefore it makes so much more sense to have as many countries as possible following the same laws in various maritime sectors. And of course, that is so, so diverse. You know, whether one is talking about the wet aspect, the dry aspect, the carriage aspect. You know, we're talking about the Hague rules, the Hague-Visby rules. All of these were CMI documents.
Okay. As president of the CMI, you've been appointed for a term of 3 years. And if I understand correctly, this is renewable for another 3 years. So in total, possibly you've got 6 years at the helm. What do you want to focus on during this period?
Well, at this stage, I think, Martina, the first thing I need to do is give thanks and credit to all the presidents that have come before me through the ages. Because, of course, during every presidency, normally there are various issues, and all the various presidents that have come before me have done their best, have worked very hard, and have taken the CMI from one stage to another. What I would really like to do during my presidency is, first and foremost, perhaps focus on the National Maritime Law Associations. Because what I didn't say is that the membership of the CMI is actually made up of the National Maritime Law Associations that exist in most countries. So the members are not individuals. So the membership of the CMI are the National Maritime Law Associations. There is then another category who we call the titulary members. These are persons who would have been elected as titulary members on the basis of their contribution to international maritime law. And then we have the consultative members. The consultative members are associations from the industry. So we're talking about BIMCO, we're talking about the International Chamber of Shipping, we're talking about the International Salvage Union, and there are so many others. And this is why the CMI gathers within it a particular strength, because we're not only talking about persons who live maritime disputes. We are not only talking about academics who provide the intellectual dimension to the drafting of conventions. We're also talking about the contributions made by the industry to the regulation of maritime activity. So all of these members come together. And going back to your question of what I would like to do within the CMI, is I would like to focus on our members a little bit more in order to ensure that the CMI continues to produce work and make suggestions to the international maritime bodies on new areas of work which perhaps need more focus. And this can only come about if we engage more with our National Maritime Law Associations, if we engage more with our titulary members, if we engage more with the industry. In fact, one of the first things I did after my election, the first courtesy visit that I paid was to the Secretary General of the IMO, Mr. Kitak Lim. And as a result of that meeting, we had a discussion on how CMI can continue to assist the IMO with its work and find new projects that we can work on and contribute towards. So that is one area I would like to focus. But then I would also like to focus on how that outreach can be done. And that is most unhesitatingly through the manner in which we communicate with our membership. Now, that can continue to be through our traditional means of publications, yearbooks, etc., which, of course, are very important. But then we need to focus particularly, I believe, on our social media. And there, I'm very happy to say that we have already revamped our newsletter, which is now going out in a more, shall we say, IT-friendly manner. And we will also be focusing on other social media platforms, such as LinkedIn. Those people who know me personally know that I am a LinkedIn fanatic. I think it is this marvelous tool where within your first 5 minutes of the morning, you know exactly what's going on all over the world. And I think it is a magnificent tool, which as CMI, we intend to exploit to its full potential.
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, you've spent the last few years working hard to complete the Convention on the International Effects of Judicial Sales of Ships. What triggered this convention?
Of course, yes, this is something which I feel very strongly about, Martina. But I have to say that I first became involved in this project late-ish. And the reason why I say late-ish is because, in actual fact, this...
9 years.
Yes, this project was born when Professor Henry Lee, who I would really extend my most sincere greetings to from here, many, many years ago, brought this problem to the attention of the Comité Maritime International. And what is this problem? The problem related to the unfortunate circumstances when a vessel is sold in a judicial sale by auction. And as we all know, especially the people hearing us today, know that when a vessel is sold in a judicial sale by auction, it's very frequently the last resort available to a creditor who remains unpaid by the vessel and therefore has no option other than to arrest that vessel and seek to sell her in a judicial sale. What is fundamental in a judicial sale by auction or private treaty is that the purchaser buys that vessel free and unencumbered. I mean, at the end of the day, what purchaser in his right senses is going to pay top dollar for a ship if, a distressed ship, if he takes that ship away without a free and unencumbered title? That is the attraction in paying and buying a ship in a distressed, under in distressed circumstances. So that is what happens in most jurisdictions. So where is the problem? The problem has arisen where, in some instances, a purchaser buys a vessel free and unencumbered in a judicial sale, starts to use her, charters her, carries cargo, carries passengers, only to find out that previous creditors, old creditors existing prior to the sale of the vessel, are attempting to rearrest that vessel for an old debt. So that is one problem that arises. And when that happens, and a vessel is arrested in those circumstances, you can only imagine it takes the new purchaser totally by surprise, because he would have paid very, very good money thinking he's bought a ship free and unencumbered. The vessel is arrested. The vessel may be under charter, so the owner would have problems with the charterer. The vessel would inevitably be carrying cargo or passengers. So what happens to the cargo? What happens to the passengers? There are delays and all these huge problems. And consequently, there is a massive interruption to the smooth flow of maritime operation and the smooth flow of international trade. Another problem that arises, that has arisen, is, for instance, if the old mortgagees refuse to have their old mortgages deleted. What happens then? You know, that is a huge disincentive for financiers to finance ships purchased in judicial sales, because even vessels purchased in judicial sales would very frequently require financing.
Of course.
So all of this was brought to the attention of the CMI, and Professor Henry Lee put together an international working group. And to cut a very long story short, in 2014, the CMI in its General Assembly in Hamburg approved what became known as the Beijing Draft Convention on the International Sale of Judicial, on the International Effects, as it was then called, Recognition of Judicial Sales. So what happens then is what always happens with the CMI in recent years, which is this. Once the CMI drafts a convention, we then need to look for a home for an international body that would change this draft into international legislation. So what happened was that we approached the IMO. When I say we, the people involved at the time on this project. As far as I am concerned, my involvement in this project was as president of the Malta Maritime Law Association, who, together with my colleagues from the Malta Maritime Law Association, participated very, very assiduously and wholeheartedly in the drafting of this convention. Why? Because it's a very important convention for Malta. Because Malta is one of the main jurisdictions where ships are brought and ships are sold in judicial sales. So it is in the interest of Malta that when ships are indeed sold in Malta free and unencumbered, that sale is given effect to by other countries. So it's very important for Malta. So we participated in that respect. So the CMI went to the IMO to see whether the IMO would take this on. And the IMO, for some reason, and regrettably at the time, felt there was no compelling need. And they needed a little bit more time to get their head around it. We then approached the UNCITRAL, and that was in 2018. And in 2017, and UNCITRAL showed interest, but said, look, what we need is, we would recommend that the CMI would go off and have an international colloquium somewhere, gather all the industry, and depending on the outcome of that colloquium, we will then rediscuss. So that is where I really had my first involvement in the making of the convention in terms of the international process, because we were able to organize a colloquium in Malta. We organized a colloquium in Malta in February of 2018, where we gathered all of the international maritime community. And when I say all, I mean most of the major key players. Again, International Chamber of Shipping, BIMCO, Seafarers, ITF, because we mustn't forget that when distressed ships are sold, the people who really suffer as a result of uncertainty are the crew members who would have been left unpaid, who are there languishing on these ships. So the quicker, the smoother, the more organized a judicial sale is, it is in their interest. So anyway, all of these people came, and the end result from the colloquium was that there was overwhelming support for the need to regulate this matter. And therefore, we send the results of the colloquium via the Swiss government to UNCITRAL. And that is when I first attended the first meeting at UNCITRAL, the commission. And there were a number of projects, because I learned that when UNCITRAL has to decide what it's going to dedicate its time to, there are a number of people vying with all their projects. And we're very fortunate that UNCITRAL was convinced that there was a need for this and decided to take this project on. And the project was handed over to Working Group 6 of UNCITRAL. And Working Group 6 of UNCITRAL met for the first time in June of the following year. And the way these things work at UNCITRAL is that the working groups meet twice a year, in June and in December. And one time they meet in New York and the other time they meet in Vienna. And the first time we therefore met to start to discuss the convention was in June 2019 in New York, followed by Vienna. And that is when I was asked to coordinate this project on behalf of the CMI. So I was the CMI coordinator for this project at UNCITRAL, and I think it would be fair to say that it was also, this period was also one of the most exciting periods of my life, to be involved in the creation of a convention in a subject matter in which I was so heavily involved through my profession, the sale of ships. And this is where the CMI comes to life, because as a result of our interventions and the interventions of so many lawyers who were part of their state delegations, who were also members of National Maritime Law Associations belonging to the CMI, we could explain to the states present there at UNCITRAL why this was required and the raison d'etre behind each and every clause. This was a process that lasted up until June of last year, June 2022. And of course, during this period, we also had 2 years of COVID where we couldn't meet in person. But the project had so much life in it, had so much going for it, that the secretariat at UNCITRAL were very keen to continue with the meetings virtually. And we used the Interprefy platform, which was very challenging, of course, because we had people who needed to wake up at the crack of dawn to follow all the meetings, or not sleep at all, depending on whether they came from Asia or from the American continent. And there I was in the middle trying to coordinate things. But it was hugely gratifying. And of course, what was especially gratifying was that in June of last year, the commission now, at UNCITRAL, the commission agreed on the final wording and agreed to submit our final draft to the General Assembly of the United Nations. The General Assembly of the United Nations approved the draft convention and adopted the convention on the 7th of December of 2022. and actually agreed and decided, rather, that the signing ceremony will be held in Beijing during the course of 2023, and that the convention will be called the Convention on the International Effects of Judicial Sales of Ships. So this is exceptionally very, very exciting for us maritime law practitioners, very exciting for the CMI. It continues to underline the value of the CMI and the importance of the CMI and the role which the CMI continues to play in the unification of international maritime law.
Thank you for that. Can have a sip of your coffee now.
I will indeed.
So what are the main takeaways from this convention?
The main takeaways from the convention are these, that the convention does not seek to interfere with domestic law, with how judicial sales are held domestically, as long as a number of boxes are ticked. So what needs to happen is that a notice of judicial sale needs to be sent out to a number of persons identified in the convention. And this was felt necessary by state parties. There was a lot of discussion on this in order to ensure that ships are not sold behind anybody's back. So a proper notification process needs to be embarked upon prior to the sale of the vessel. Very importantly, when we were discussing this issue, a number of state parties represented by persons who perhaps did not have such a thorough knowledge of the sector said, but, you know, how do we know that everybody who ought to be notified is going to be notified? So the idea came about that the convention should provide for the creation of what we called a repository. And so in order to allay everybody's fears, these notices of judicial sale, apart from being served on the persons identified, so it's the owner, the mortgagee, creditors who would have made their claim known to the court concerned, this notice of judicial sale would also be sent to the repository. And the repository is none other than the IMO. Because what we need to say is that by the time that we were really deliberating this draft at UNCITRAL, the IMO came round to understanding and appreciating how important this convention really was to international trade and to the international maritime community. And therefore, and the IMO actually took part in all the deliberations at UNCITRAL. And they were hugely supportive of the convention at UNCITRAL and contributed significantly to a refinement of the wording of the convention and, in fact, ultimately agreed to be the repository. And, of course, the IMO, which has access, I mean, every ship has an IMO number, and the IMO itself has got what is called the GISIS platform, G-I-S-I-S. And this is a platform which is already available where information available to the public is readily available. So all that has to be done now is for another module to be created on this already existing GISIS platform. So literally any Tom, Dick or Harry can see whether a ship he would be interested in is up for a judicial sale. So the notice of judicial sale needs to be sent to the IMO and the IMO will upload it on their GISIS platform. The next takeaway is that the certificate of judicial sale as well, which will need to be issued by the court, which would be selling the vessel, needs to be sent to the repository. But of course, before it's sent to the repository, the first takeaway is that the convention provides for a certificate of judicial sale to be issued by the court authorizing the sale. And the certificate of judicial sale will state that the vessel was sold, how much it was sold for, to whom it was sold for, to whom it was sold to. I said the price, that it is being sold free and unencumbered. Of course, that is the raison d'etre behind all of this, that it is sold free and unencumbered. And the certificate would actually annotate all of this. So that's the next takeaway. The other takeaway, which of course is hugely important, is that signatory states oblige themselves to ensure that when the certificate of judicial sale is presented to the registrar of shipping, where the vessel is registered, that registrar is obliged to give effect to that certificate of judicial sale, and he must therefore either delete the vessel, if that is what is being required by the new purchaser, or effect a transfer of ownership to in the name of the new purchaser. Once there is this certificate of judicial sale, and say individual, a person, an entity tries to arrest a ship sold in a judicial sale, that vessel must be released immediately on the production of the certificate of judicial sale. And so we have removed the subjectivity. You know, there is one objective criteria, presentation of certificate of judicial sale. If that certificate of judicial sale is presented, then the purchaser has a right to have that vessel deleted, has a right to register new mortgages, has a right to have that vessel registered somewhere else, has a right to have his ship released from arrest if it's been arrested by another entity for debts incurred by the previous owner. So it's all really very, very exciting, again, for people who are involved in this sector in particular.
Thank you for that. What was the biggest learning curve for you with this convention? I don't think it's the first law you've ever drafted, but perhaps the largest on an international scale that you have participated in.
Unhesitatingly, absolutely, Martina. I mean, we throughout our work, we have assisted authorities locally with the drafting of many, many, many maritime-related rules, regulations, laws, subsidiary legislation. On an international level, the last time I ever was involved in a convention was in the Arrest of Ships Convention, 1999. Which ironically was never ratified by Malta, but that was also a very exciting experience. However, this was my first experience of not participating actively and leading discussions and explaining to the international bodies and to the delegates present what each and every clause in the draft meant, where it came from, and what we intended to, what wanted to achieve by each and every clause. It was fascinating for me to find myself in this forum, which one needs to understand is a forum at UNCITRAL, which gathers the members of UNCITRAL, all the states of UNCITRAL, which stands for the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. And in my very first meeting, I realized that the people who are representing states are all hugely experienced, seasoned diplomats who represent their countries, either based in New York or based in Vienna, depending on where we're meeting. So one thing I had to get my head around was that all of these persons were hugely experienced, seasoned diplomats, but not many of them actually had or knew of the peculiarities, shall we say, related to ships, to carriage of goods, to carriage of passengers, to the fact that you can even arrest a vessel. So in our first meeting, it was really very interesting to be involved in explaining to people what happens out there in real life. And soon after this very first meeting, it was rather gratifying to see, for instance, at the next meeting, that delegations then went out of their way to bring with them maritime lawyers. So our discussions could evolve and develop even further. It made me understand how when you're drafting laws on an international level, that you need to make sure that you remain focused on your goal, but you need also to understand that there are allowances which may need to be made sometimes in order to ensure that the instrument that you would be creating at the end would be an instrument that is ratifiable by as many states as possible. And what I mean by this is the following. For instance, in private practice, very often, you would read a convention And you would come across a clause and you would say, good grief, you know, now what on earth did they mean to say by this? Now I understand that sometimes wording needs to be chosen in a manner so as to ensure that various states can live with it. And sometimes, you know, you need to make that allowance to encourage member states to ratify the convention, because if not, then what is the point of having a convention which nobody's going to ratify? So, you know, very often there is that fine line, and I've learned
how to...
It is indeed a balancing act. And it's very interesting, of course, to be involved in the drafting of something like this when at the same time you happen to be involved in the coalface. You know, we're handling arrests at the coalface. We are at the coalface. We are selling ships. So it was useful for me to be able to contribute to a discussion on how whatever it is that we are going to decide can or cannot work in real life.
So the good news is that after all this hard work, you've actually got a convention that has come to fruition, that has been accepted. And now all that is left is the signing, which will take place in Beijing. Do you have an indication when it's going to be signed, or is this still up in the air?
Yes, I have two comments about that. One is the signing date, and the second is all that has to be done. We'll start with the last bit. The last bit is we don't have a date yet, but the indications are that it will probably be during September of this year, which is great news in Beijing. Going to the all that is left, the next stage is the signing. What comes after is
lobbying.
As important as what has happened over the last... It is the lobbying. It is the explanation to countries, to states, to governments,
to ratify,
why it is important to ratify it. Now, the good thing is that the convention will come into force on the ratification of the third state. That's another thing
that's
we're particularly
so
happy about. No.
You should get that.
Yes, but of course, it will come into force. But it's only going to work if as many states as possible are going to. And in this respect, it is really and truly heartening to see so many countries which are organizing these various events throughout the year, aimed at explaining to their governments and to the industry why it is important for these countries to ratify the convention. And the CMI hopes to play a very real role in this effort. And from here, I would like to extend an absolute open invitation to any National Maritime Law Association which requires assistance from the CMI. We are a big group that has worked on this convention. From here, I would like to thank the international working group within the CMI that has worked very, very hard to draft the convention, but also to carry this convention through UNCITRAL, because I was only one of a very substantial group of people. And now we're entering the third phase, in fact. We call it International Working Group 3 at the CMI, which is actively working on the how we can assist with the ratification process.
So it may well be that this podcast is going to be aired during the first week of March, which will also coincide with International Women's Day. Anne, what is your message here?
Yes, this is a subject which has fascinated me for some time, Martina. And the actual honest answer to that is how I wish we had reached the stage where we don't even need International Women's Day. I mean, I find it so bizarre that in 2023, we are still talking about the need of International Women's Day, when to my mind, the only thing that should really have anything to do with people's progression is competence. And where male and female just doesn't come into the equation at all. And in a way, I feel very fortunate, but I also feel sometimes that I may be living in a bit of a world of my own, because I have to say, hand on heart, that throughout my career, which is now getting there in terms of years, I feel that because of the manner in which I have been brought up principally, and perhaps the manner in which my brain is wired, that I never felt as though there was an issue in terms of discrimination. Now, this doesn't mean that I never came across persons in my entire career who said or did silly things, but the point is I probably just put them to the back of my mind. And consequently, I just got on with whatever it is that I had to do, because I so believed in the fact that, you know, if you work hard enough, then the world was your oyster. But I have been very fortunate in my career, and I need to acknowledge this, to be surrounded by people, male and female, who have constantly encouraged me. Especially the males in my life, both on a personal level, starting with my dad and my husband and my children, and the males I happen to be working with, wherever that was, never brought being a female into the equation. But, and this is where perhaps I am living in a very fortunate environment, or where I have lived in a fortunate environment, I acknowledge the fact that that is not the case with women everywhere, all the time, far from it. The very fact that we feel the need to have International Women's Day, the fact that clearly women still are in the minority when it comes to occupying important positions in organizations, the fact that there are still very few women, comparatively speaking, on boards, speaks volumes. Now, what does this mean? Does this mean that women are less competent than men? Of course not. Obviously not. It means that we need to reinforce our educational system. And I think this is something on a worldwide basis, where we clearly bring up our children and the younger generation in understanding and really appreciating equality, where barriers simply don't exist for whatever reason, where we need to, if possible, if necessary, shake away this possible mentality of there being a difference between men and women in terms of capability. However, when it comes to ability, and when it comes to the ability to do something, then the criteria can never be on whether a person is a male or whether a person is a female, but it also and always has to be down to competence. And then at the end of the day, from a personal experience, I can say that being on a board with men and women, competent men and women, just changes the dynamic. It makes for a more interesting environment. It makes for a more compassionate environment. It makes for a more realistic environment. And in my personal experience, every board or organization that I have participated in, which happens to have a fairly even distribution of decision makers between men and women, tends to make for a much more all-round organization, where the dynamic is better and where the results are better. And of course, if I were to talk about the CMI, I'm very proud to say that we have a number of international working groups have many ladies, if not all. I am sure all our international working groups have lady lawyers participating very actively within the working groups, and some lead the working groups. Our Secretary General is a female, Rosalie Balkin. I would like to say hello to her from here. So, you know, as far as the CMI is concerned, it's all about competence. And females and lady lawyers have a very, very, very strong presence. So the message here is that the CMI will welcome wholeheartedly every single lady lawyer who wishes to participate, who wishes to work hard and join us in this very exciting maritime voyage on the unification of international maritime law.
Okay, this is a wrap. Thank you very much, Anne, for joining us, and until our next episode.